Is it on now? Okay. Jeff is the Springshed Mapping Hydrologist for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources in the Rochester office. He has been working on groundwater issues in southeast Minnesota since 1990 for 22 long years. He has a master's in water resources management from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and is licensed as a professional geologist by the state of Minnesota. I might also add personally that he is a nationally respected among karst professionals who look forward to his talks annually on his research on Minnesota karst at the national meetings on karst. Thank you, Jeff.
Good morning. I'm going to muddle through this right before I came in. I lost a contact lens, so like half of you are blurry and half of you are clear, and this is going to be really interesting. And I used to think Kelton was my friend, and then he scheduled this, and I'm after Beth and Jesse and Tony and right before lunch. So thanks, Kelton. Well, we're going to talk about the St. Lawrence Aqua Tartifer, and I'm really jealous that Tony thought of that term before I did, because I really like it. But we'll talk about that and some of the work we've been doing. And you know, Tony said he felt about this big. Well, I feel about like that big, because, you know, we got these people doing all this nifty downhole stuff, and I'm a guy who finds water going underground and I dump dye in it. Well, we're talking about southeast Minnesota, you know, the thick bedrock sequence here. Southeast Minnesota. And then the glaciers miss southeast Minnesota, so I know a lot of the folks at MGS don't like it when we use the term driftless area, but we still call it the driftless area because local people know what that means. So we're talking about the southeast, this area down here, and I will try to point to both sides. So it's that thick layer of sedimentary rock, and we got the coulees, that rugged landscape, and it's, you know, there's been a lot of work going on. Tony talked about people, you know, like Kelvin and I die tracing. There's been people die tracing in the southeast since the 60s. Kelvin started in the mid-70s. I started in the early 90s. So there's been a lot of work going on in southeast Minnesota. And we got our nice stratigraphic column, and I won't go through this much, just to say that we're looking at the St. Lawrence Formation. Well, the St. Lawrence, you know, people think it's a historically, it's been called a confining unit, a low permeability unit, aquitard. This is from the MGS from the late 70s, and you can see where it's described as a confining bed, and that was based on head differences between it and the overlying, or between the formations above and below it. It's in our well code. This is in our state water well code. It talks about 10 feet of the St. Lawrence being considered a confining unit for drilling a water well. We've known for a long time that it has water coming out of it. This is from the Winona County Geologic Atlas, and you can, you know, it's from 1984, and you can see where they looked at, and this is from Kelvin Alexander, it had the karsted Paradisiacum above it, the Jordan sandstone, and then springs coming out of the St. Lawrence. And that's been known a long time. And when I started in southeast Minnesota, I figured that out pretty quickly too, and could see that happening out in the landscape. Well, the St. Lawrence, when you go look at it, it's dolostone, siltstone, some fine-grained sandstone. It's it varies a lot vertically. This is one of the limestone beds towards the base, and you can see these vertical fractures that Tony was talking about. And as we've been looking at it more and more, we start seeing things that look like solution conduits. You can see one here and see one there. You know, vertical fracture solution conduits, and you start to wonder what it is you're looking at. This is a close-up of one of those things that looks like a solution conduit in a vertical fracture. And this is a photo that actually Jeremy Revord took when we were out in the field on Monday in southern Winona County. And you can see it. It certainly looks like a solution conduit to me. And the St. Lawrence is pretty extensive across the southeast. It's that subcrop, it's that red line on this map. And we have lots of trout stream springs that are fed by the St. Lawrence. And it's a real key to our world-class trout streams. Southeast Minnesota's trout streams are world-class. And the St. Lawrence is an important component in providing water to them. And this is an example of one of the springs. This is a headwater spring of Gorman Creek in Wabasha County, and it's discharging from the St. Lawrence. Well, when you do this, you use die tracing, and I wish I could read that, but it's kind of hard. this is a real challenge. We're doing the die tracing to map spring sheds, as Tony was just talking about, and the dyes we used were fluorescein or uranine C, rhodamine WT, and eosine. And the analysis is done at the University of Minnesota. I neglected to mention when I started this talk, this work is being funded by the Environmental Natural Resources Trust Fund, as recommended by the LCCMR, and it's part of our innovative spring shed mapping project, which Kelvin Alexander and I are the two principal investigators on. And this is a dye trace, a bug, a passive charcoal detector. This is full of coconut charcoal. This is what we use to find our dye, so you don't have to be there every day taking water samples. And we put the packets out in the springs or as close as possible to the springs and change them at regular intervals. And then they go up to the University of Minnesota lab, and Kelvin and Scott Alexander analyze them in their Shimadzu scanning spectrofluorophotometer. And this is an example of what we see. This is a peak for fluorescein. This is a positive dye trace. Fluorescein that refluoresces at 515 nanometers, and there's a nice solid peak here showing us that we've got dye. Well, back in 2007, we had just started this project, and we had our mega rainstorm. We set a 24-hour rainfall record. We had 17 inches of rain. Six people died. And it was a catastrophic flash flood event. Shortly after, and it rearranged the landscape in many ways. This is Rush Creek, but the bridge in the background is Interstate 90, and you can see all the rock deposited. A lot of the streams changed from being kind of long meandering riffle streams to having big pools because they were blocked with debris. So it made a lot of changes. Well, one of the things that happened was shortly after that, I got a call from the city of Rushford, Minnesota, saying that their municipal wells were contaminated with floodwaters. And about 6 miles north of town, a local trapper had found a stream sinking underground. And I knew we were low in the section, kind of wondered what was going on, so I went out and looked at it. And what we found was water disappearing into the ground. And this stream was just kind of dribbling away. And there's a bigger pool up here. And it didn't really look like the kind of thing that that we see for classic karst disappearing streams. This is what we think of for classic karst disappearing streams, water just swirling around, going straight into the ground, not just sort of dribbling away. Well, we ran a dye trace from this. November of 2007, right before I went to Bolivia for the first time, or for the second time. And we let dye loose, thinking we would see it months later from some St. Lawrence springs. And what we found instead was this was like 1 to 2 weeks later. And then you can see 2 to 3 weeks later, we start to get a nice solid fluorescein peak. That green dye was fluorescein. And then the tail, we still had dye coming months later. And we discovered that the dye was moving at hundreds of meters per day through the St. Lawrence Aquitard confining unit, and we put it at this first point here, and it came out of this spring and then these two springs. This was 1 to 2 weeks, and this was 2 to 3 weeks. So this is moving pretty fast, and you know that's not what we thought of for a confining unit. And this is the first spring it came out the first time, and this is Wolfram Spring and Borson Spring. Well, we tried to trace again. Kelvin came down, Scott Alexander came down, and we let dye loose. It was sinking a little further downstream, and we used ISCO samplers to get a much tighter dye recovery curve. And what we found was dye was moving at hundreds of meters per day, and it actually came out of Wolfram Spring first, and this is where it went in, and you can see it's about 6 days, and the dye started coming through a nice, clean breakthrough curve. So we had dye moving through the St. Lawrence, you know, at 100 meters, hundreds of meters per day, going in the top and coming out the bottom. We started looking for other places where this might be happening. And this was in the Kiefer Valley in the Whitewater. It's a stream that disappears. I first heard about this one when the Pollution Control Agency called me about a milk spill. And literally a guy left me a message and told me they had spilled milk. And I was kind of like, why are you calling me about spilled milk? I had been on vacation. I didn't know there had been a 4,000-gallon tanker tip over. just upstream of this. And it was interesting because when I looked at the air photo, I could tell right away the water was going underground because there was a black line on the black and white air photo, and then the stream bed was white, which is the limestone cobble. So I knew it was sinking underground. And that was even before the 07 flood. And then I started putting pieces together, and we went out there, and lo and behold, we ran a dye trace, and this is what we found. We got dye moving from the sink to these springs, and again, it was moving at hundreds of meters per day. This is the spring it came out, one of the springs it came out of. Well, Andrew Peters worked with me for a couple of years. In fact, he's here today. And he went out looking for more of these because this was part of our project. And this is Daly Creek in Houston County. And we saw the same thing as we saw at the other two sites. We put dye into a sinking stream, and it came out of spring coming out of the base of the St. Lawrence. And it took 1 to 2 weeks to find our dye. And again, we're getting that same high flow rate. And this is the spring it came out of. It's going by a guy named Larry Ellett, so we call it Ellett Spring. Well, we started using LIDAR because one of the benefits, if you can call it that, of the 07 flood was we got high resolution one meter LIDAR for southeast Minnesota. And looking at that, we were using that to try to find our sinking points. And this is the original trace on Ahrensfeld Creek that was north of Rushford. And by the way, we never did find dye in the city of Rushford well that we were sampling. In fact, I was just there on Monday, and the guy had mentioned he still has a dye trace bug hanging in his municipal well if we want to come back and grab it. Well, we looked at the LIDAR, and when I looked at the LIDAR and looked at the topographic maps, you could see here's where the water was sinking. There's this big valley to the east, right here, and that big valley had no water coming out of it, which was kind of interesting because it's got a large watershed but no stream at the mouth. It had a dry stream bed. Well, when I looked at the LIDAR, and again, this stuff is all kind of hard for me to see, but you can see the stream. This is the Ahrensfeld Creek, our original trace. The channel comes down, and then this channel smooths out, kind of disappears right about where we were losing our flow. So I looked at the LIDAR for that next stream, and lo and behold, you could see the same thing. And Julia and Tony and I went out there, and the stream was, in fact, sinking underground. The landowner had told me that the water sank there, and he was right. And we poured dye there, and it came out of St. Lawrence Springs. And again, it was at hundreds of meters per day, or tens to hundreds of meter per day flow rate. When you're changing your samplers every week or two, you know, you don't get a real fine resolution on your velocity. But this dye went in, and it came out of Borson Spring and this unnamed spring, whereas on Ahrensfeld Creek, it came out of these other two springs. So that over here. So it's a complex flow path that we're seeing, and we're basically mapping spring sheds. Well, as we kept looking for these things, this is down Sullivan Creek, down by Holcomb, Minnesota. And it was the same thing. The water was sinking underground. In fact, it was sinking in two places. And we ran a dye trace from that. And we saw, again, this complex pattern where water went in and came out of springs. And actually, the downstream trace we ran, which is right there. We never found that one, even though there were springs coming out of the bed of the creek. There's always that question, is this dye just moving through the rubble in the creek bed? And I would say not, just based on everything we've been seeing, where we have dye coming out of springs that come right out of the bedrock. And in this case, for example, we put dye in here, and it didn't come out of this spring, which is right downstream and rises right out of the stream bed. Well, in December of that year, Jeremy Revord and I snowshoed back up this valley on a nice December day when it was about 0 degrees. And we went in at dark because I've had too many cases where I pour dye into surface waters and people see it and then they do things like call the state duty officer and complain about a spill in the creek. And actually, one of the things that happens to me whenever someone sees colored water, one of the things the pollution control agency and the health department staff do is they call me and want to know if I'm dye tracing. So if you pour the dye at night, people are less likely to see it. So Jeremy and I snowshoed in, released the dye, and it came out of this spring, if I'm seeing this right, and it came out of a domestic well. The people who owned this stream, because this stream doesn't disappear, it just flows across the St. Lawrence subcrop, but it doesn't disappear. We poured dye in it, and it's still leaking into the subsurface. So now we're showing that it doesn't have to disappear. It can, you know, recharge the St. Lawrence formation just by flowing across it, which is pretty significant. One of the things we're realizing, of course, is that the shaded area on this, that's the all the upland area that's contributing to these sinking streams and losing streams. So that whole upland area is, in fact, affecting groundwater quality, groundwater resources in the valley below. So this has big implications for water resource management in southeast Minnesota. There's a lot of these St. Lawrence streams. You know, this is a subcrop, and if you're getting impacts on the groundwater from streams just simply crossing it, you've opened up a whole area, the whole southeast to being impacted by upland land management. Well, we looked at another spot. This is Indian Springs, and Indian Springs also doesn't disappear. It flows across the St. Lawrence, and we poured dye, and again, it came out of springs coming out of the bedrock, and it was another example of that flow we saw in Sullivan Creek, where you're not disappearing, but yet you're still losing to the groundwater system. Well, this is a Solenist level temperature connectivity logger graph from Crystal Springs State Fish Hatchery, which was the last St. Lawrence trace we've done. And we're still actively looking for these things. In fact, I just yesterday sent Julia and Tony a map from Crystal Creek in Houston County, and they confirmed that, in fact, it looks like we've got another St. Lawrence sinking stream. So we've got more than we've dye traced from. We're working on these. But this is a Solenist graph, and the state fish hatcheries, we've got three of them in southeast Minnesota, and they're a real critical resource. They raise trout for stocking across the state. And the Lanesboro hatchery, we have already demonstrated in the past that it's connected to the surface, and that would be a whole nother talk to talk about Lanesboro. Crystal Springs, we're hoping was protected from the surface, from surface impacts. Well, we had the Solenist out, and you can see this is temperature, this is conductivity. And right about here, you see the temperature start to make some little spikes, and the conductivity is bouncing around, which it had done before. But as we looked at this and with these dates, that was about when a tributary, you know, over here too, you can see these spikes temperature. That was about when this tributary to the hatchery, to the whitewater, started sinking underground. And Kelvin had run a trace the year before in this setting when the water was sinking into the Jordan sandstone, and he never saw the dye. The stream had this terminal sink had migrated downstream, so now it was sinking into the St. Lawrence, and we poured dye in August, it was August of last year, and the dye came out of one of the two springs at the Crystal Springs State Fish Hatchery. And it was almost amusing because they had just hired a brand new manager, and the first time I met him, I was like, hi, you know, guess what? Your hatchery is connected to the surface, which if you run a state fish hatchery, you don't want surface water because these are multi-million dollar operations and diseases can come in and they'll kill all your trout. So being connected to the surface is a really bad thing. And so when he just started, you know, he got this really bad news that all of a sudden your hatchery is much more vulnerable to surface contamination than anyone ever thought. So he wasn't real happy with that bit of news when he got hired. We are in the process of still monitoring this dye trace, and one of the things we want to do is pour dye into the Whitewater River, which is over here, and see if that, in fact, is losing into the groundwater system as well. Well, this is kind of a compendium of what we've seen, yeah, and our flow rates, and you can see our breakthrough flow speeds, and we're in that, as low as 35 meters per day at Sullivan to as high as 600 meters per day at our second Ahrensfeld trace where we use the direct water sample. So I would say what we're seeing are flow rates of hundreds of meters per day through this confining unit or aquitard. And Tony showed you this earlier. The water is, in fact, going in the top. We've been very careful to look at the outcrops, look at the stratigraphy. The water goes in the top and exits the bottom. So it's going into the top of this confining unit going through it and coming out of it at the base, and it's doing this it's doing this over a horizontal distance of several kilometers, a vertical distance of about 20 meters, and it's doing this in a matter of a couple weeks, which makes me wonder why we call it a confining unit. This is one of Tony's diagrams showing you this kind of what we think is going on. The water is going in and stair-stepping its way down through these bedding plane fractures and coming out the base. Well, we've done this work in several counties. When the first trace we did, we thought, well, this is just a localized phenomenon, but we've realized now it's in fact a regional phenomenon. We're looking at a site up here in northern Wabasha County, in fact, to run a trace where water is moving across the St. Lawrence and not sinking. We've got these spots where we've identified St. Lawrence streams that are sinking under, or streams that are sinking into the St. Lawrence, so we've got a lot more work to do. We're hoping to do, we just ran into a professor from, a retired professor in Wisconsin, and we were telling him about this, so if he can find a St. Lawrence sinking stream, I told him I'd take a vacation day and come over and pour dye, you know, and see what's going on over there. So our conclusions, which I can hardly read, so I'll let you read those, but basically, we're at this concept of being an aquatardifer, and water's moving through the St. Lawrence, it's moving fast. There is not a separation from the surface like we thought with these St. Lawrence springs. There are thousands of St. Lawrence springs across the southeast. They're really key for our trout streams. And so trying to understand what's going on with them and continue this work is really important. And as I was telling Jeff Stoner from the USGS before, during the break, when we started this project, this springshed mapping project, we thought we were going to be looking at the Prairie du Chien and the Galena limestone. And we had no idea we were going to be adding the St. Lawrence, and it gave us several orders of magnitude more work to do. But we think this is really significant work because, again, this unit that was thought to be a confining unit, in fact, is not. And this is a shameless plug for the poster session. This is not Minnesota. This is, in fact, Bolivia, and I have a Bolivia poster, so this is a shameless plug for that. And lunch is next. I encourage you to go to the posters, and I think I got done really fast.
You did.
So.
So in reference to the what used to be the St. Lawrence confining bed, it looks like that the functional confinement actually is at the base of the St. Lawrence.
Yeah, we're seeing that from what Tony has been talking about, and what we're seeing is that it's the top of the tunnel city, or Franconia is the confinement. Yeah, that's what we're seeing.
I'm just curious, in relationship to the trout streams and funding sources, have you thought of or approached Trout Unlimited, or do they have any interest in the work that you're doing?
They have a lot of interest. We've talked to them. They write letters of support to the LCCMR when we apply for funding. So, yeah, they are supportive. In terms of funding, no, they're more into the putting rocks in streams and, you know, working on habitat right in the streams than funding this kind of work. But they are supportive. Like I said, they do advocate for us.
I think it's worth clarifying, following up on, I think that was Justin who asked a question earlier.
Yeah.
That it's worth pointing out that virtually all these dye traces are in places where the St. Lawrence's uppermost bedrock, or very close to uppermost bedrock. And there are, although there's not a wealth of data, there are indications that in the deeper subsurface, it tightens up considerably in a vertical direction in terms of the interconnectivity between the vertical fractures. So, and that supports the notion also in a different way of the aquatardifer, depending on the geologic setting you're in, if that makes any sense.
No, and that's a good point. One of the other things we're going to do, Tony now has been trained in to use the, remind me what that's called. I'm blanking on the geophysic tool we're going to use.
Gamma?
No, it's the micro. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on it. Tony, help me out here. What the depth of bedrock? Passive seismic. We're going to do that in some of these sites this summer to see how deep it is to the St. Lawrence. We've got a pretty good handle on where the St. Lawrence top is, you know, in the outcrops next to the streams, but we don't know how much of it's been removed. So we want to see, you know, where exactly in the section is our dye going in. So that's one of the things we're going to be doing this summer. Other questions?
Say, Jeff, quick question for you to follow up on what Tony was saying. When you were looking for a dye in the valleys, did you look at any wells that were finished in the Franconia or the Tunnel City in the valleys? Did you see any dye in those wells?
At the Indian Springs Trace, we looked at some deeper wells, and we did not see any dye. But that's something we need to do more of, look at the wells through these valleys just to see what we might find. But we did try that at Indian Springs, and we didn't sample. We sampled for a month or two at the wells, but and never saw anything.
I know the focus today is on sedimentary rocks in southern Minnesota, but my wife and I live up on Iron Range, and I'm a little curious. Of course, we have sedimentary iron formations, but we have the Mid-Continent Rift bumps up right against it to the northeast end and runs all the way down here. Are we going to have any investigation of the hydrology of those volcanic intrusions, the Mid-Continent Rift, which covers a tremendous area of northern Minnesota? I'm impressed by what you're doing looking at the karst formation in southern Minnesota. Are we going to get the DNR or the Geological Survey to do some work in St. Louis County and Lake County?
I am the wrong guy to answer that question. I will defer to some senior DNR or MGS people who I know are here, because I'm the wrong guy to ask. I work and live in the Southeast, so I believe there's actually things going on up there, but I'm serious. I'll defer to Harvey or Jenny or Julie or somebody else who's much more senior than I am.
I'm sure if they had the money, they'd love to. Any other last questions?
I was just going to remind all the hydrological geniuses here that there have been at least 2,000 exploratory drill holes punched into the Duluth Complex, and we have a great core library at the DNR Lands and Minerals in Hibbing.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a well-organized core library there. So if somebody wanted to do some basic investigation, we have the material.
Well, Jeff, I'll try to address that as well as I can. You know, the survey works through a variety of programs to accomplish mapping across the state. And each of them has their own idiosyncrasies in terms of where we get funding and how we do them and what the products are. We've certainly spent a lot of time thinking about northeastern Minnesota in terms of hydrology. We've certainly done we've done more mapping in northeastern Minnesota than almost any other part of Minnesota over the years. The hydrology has not been investigated as much. One of the things we look at is, you know, if we went into northeastern Minnesota to do a county geologic atlas, it's a completely different data set. It's a completely different setting. You don't have the road network that you do over the rest of the state. We don't have the water wells to work from. So we would have to design a different kind of product, and also have to acknowledge the different kind of hydrology that exists in that part of the state. So we're perfectly willing to go there, and I expect that we will at some point. We have done extensive studies of this type across the Mesabi Iron Range, which were supported by LCCMR, and those have been done, but those are not in the areas currently being considered for mining. So it's certainly something we're interested in doing when the right programs are in place to do that.